Hey everybody, Michael Gunger here.
Hello, Emily Capshaw here.
We're so excited to tell you about two new events that we're launching this fall. The first is called Commune.
Commune is a two-night intensive that we'll be bringing to a bunch of different cities where anybody from any background, any place in your faith experience or your beliefs, you're all welcome to come experience community that's not based in a common fundamentalist belief, but instead is a radically inclusive, universal space for community. So there will be sessions and teachings and song and dance and opportunities to connect with each other in person and be seen and heard and leave on a love high.
Yeah, Commune is great for like deconstructing Christians and people who want to find community together that are not interested in strict dogma or fundamentalism or anything like that. And then for those of you who want to go deeper, who want to engage in some spiritual practice together that's a little more intense and maybe a little wilder, exploring unitive consciousness with each other, the One Retreat may be the perfect fit for you. In fact, you could do both. We're actually going to do the Commune events in these cities followed immediately by the One Retreat. So it would be possible for you to do both or either. We're bringing these events to Nashville and to Chicago and to Atlanta and to the LA area, with more events to be added soon. Go to theliturgists.com and you can see some videos about these events, read a little bit more about them, and grab some tickets if you'd like. We'd love to see you.
Welcome to the Liturgist Podcast. You are now listening to Black History is American History. Hey everyone, it's William Matthews, and I'm excited for you to hear these last two episodes of Black History is American History. On this episode, we're going to focus on the words of two men who early on had two very different opinions, but by the end of both of their lives, were very close together, closer than you may think. Two preachers known by Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. I want you to really pay attention and hear the nuances in their words. I want you to hear the perspective they're coming from. I want you to feel transported back to the 1960s when you hear this. So to start things off, here is Dr. Martin Luther King having a conversation back in May 1967, only 11 months before his death.
Do you think white people in this country, and I'm talking about non-segregationist people devoid or thinking they're devoid of racism, do you have any idea of what they want the Negro to be in America?
Well, it depends on the level that we are talking here, because I think you have to make a distinction between the people who are genuinely and absolutely committed in the white community on the question of racial equality. And I must confess that I think they are in a very small minority. I think the vast majority of white Americans will go but so far. It's a kind of installment plan for equality, and they are always looking for an excuse to go but so far.
Why are they looking for the excuse? What is it about the Negro? I mean, every other group that came as an immigrant somehow, not easily, but somehow got around it. Is it just the fact that Negroes are black?
That's a part of it, and growing, that grows out of something else. You can't thingify anything without depersonalizing that something. If you use something as a means to an end, at that moment you make it a thing and you depersonalize it. The fact is that the Negro was a slave in this country for 244 years. That was a willful thing that was done. The Negro was brought here in chains, treated in very inhuman fashion. And this led to the thingification of the Negro. So he was not looked upon as a person. He was not looked upon as a human being with the same status and worth as other human beings. And the other thing is that human beings cannot continue to do wrong without eventually rationalizing that wrong. So slavery was justified morally, biologically, theoretically, scientifically, everything else. And it seems to me that white America must see that no other ethnic group has been a slave on American soil. That is one thing that other immigrant groups haven't had to face. The other thing is that the color became a stigma. American society made the Negro's color a stigma. And that can never be overlooked. So I think these things are absolutely necessary. The other thing is that America freed the slaves in 1863 through the Emancipation Proclamation of Abraham Lincoln, but gave the slaves no land or nothing in reality, and as a matter of fact, to get started on. At the same time, America was giving away millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest, which meant that there was a willingness to give the white peasants from Europe an economic base. And yet it refused to give its black peasants from Africa, who came here involuntarily in chains and had worked free for 244 years, any kind of economic base. And so emancipation for the Negro was really freedom to hunger. It was freedom to the winds and rains of heaven. It was freedom without food to eat or land to cultivate, and therefore it was freedom and famine at the same time. And when white Americans tell the Negro to lift himself by his own bootstraps, they don't look over the legacy of slavery and segregation. I believe we ought to do all we can and seek to lift ourselves by our own bootstraps, but it's a cruel jest to say to a bootless man that he ought to lift himself by his own bootstraps. And many Negroes, by the thousands and millions, have been left bootless as a result of all of these years of oppression and as a result of a society that deliberately made his color a stigma and something worthless and degrading.
But you know that many young Negroes don't want anything that smacks of the American white middle class. But do they want something that smacks of whatever is the black middle class, or do they just not want bourgeois values, which after all are the basis of this democracy?
Well, I think we have to see what they are saying. I would be the first to agree that integration does not mean giving up everything that has an Afro-American taint, so to speak. A background. I think there are certain unique things within any culture and certain cultural patterns that when you get to the process of amalgamation can really lift the whole culture. And it seems to me that integration at its best is the opportunity to participate in the beauty of diversity. I think the other thing that we've got to see is that these young people are saying that there must be a revolution of values in our country. As Jimmy Baldwin said on one occasion, what advantage is there in being integrated into a burning house? And I feel that there is a need for a revolution of values in America, because some of the values that presently exist are certainly out of line with the values and the idealistic structure that brought our nation into being. Unfortunately, we haven't been true to these ideals, and many of the values of so-called white middle-class society are values that need to be reviewed and re-evaluated, and in a real sense, they need to be changed. So I think the young people in the Negro community who are raising these questions are raising some very profound questions about our total society. In other words, they are saying that there must be a restructuring of the architecture of our society where values are concerned. And with this, I would agree with. So in the quest for integration, I think we can offer our whole nation something, because there are three evils in our nation. It's not only racism, but economic exploitation of poverty would be one, and then militarism. And I think in a sense, and in a very real sense, these three are tied inextricably together, and we aren't going to get rid of one without getting rid of the other.
When you stood on the Lincoln Memorial that day in August, 63, and you said, "I had a dream," Did that dream envision that you could see a war in Asia preventing the federal government doing for the Negroes, preventing the society doing for the Negroes, that which you think had to be done?
No, I didn't envision that then. I must confess that that period was a great period of hope for me. And I'm sure for many others all across the nation, many of the Negroes who had about lost hope, saw a solid decade of progress in the South. And in 1954, which was, 64, 1963, 9 years after the Supreme Court's decision to be in the March on Washington, meant a great deal. It was a high moment, a great watershed moment. But I must confess that that dream that I had that day has at many points turned into a nightmare. Now, I'm not one to lose hope. I keep on hoping. I still have faith in the future. But I've had to analyze many things over the last few years, and I would say over the last few months. I've gone through a lot of soul-searching and agonizing moments. And I've come to see that we have many more difficult days ahead, and some of the old optimism was a little superficial, and now it must be tempered with a solid realism. And I think the realistic fact is that we still have a long, long way to go, and that we are involved in a war on Asian soil, which, if not checked and stopped, can poison the very soul of our nation.
Here are the words of Malcolm X on February 21st, 1965, only 3 weeks before his assassination.
Black Muslims have sometimes, whether you have or not, and I think probably you have sometimes, it seemed to me, been preaching hate to meet hate.
I don't advocate any kind of hate.
But there's a lot of talk that sounds very much like it.
No, I think that the guilt complex of the American white man is so profound until when you begin to analyze the real condition of the black man in America, instead of the American white man eliminating the causes that create that condition, he tries to cover it up by accusing his accusers of teaching hate. But actually, they're just exposing him for being responsible for what exists.
Well, that's something of an argument, but I've heard speeches made by some of the people of your group. I think I've heard you make speeches. It seemed to me that you were advocating what I would have to describe, I think, as violence to meet the serious injuries that have been done your people, with which I totally agree.
I don't call that violence. I don't in any way encourage black people to go out and initiate acts of aggression indiscriminately against whites. But I do believe that the black man in the United States and any human being anywhere is well within his right to do whatever is necessary by any means necessary to protect his life and property, especially in a country where the federal government itself has proven that it is either unable or unwilling to protect the lives and property of those human beings.
Just before Pierre takes it, you've got a pretty good fighter and the world's heavyweight champion lined up with you to help out. Yes, Pierre.
Well, Mr. X, if I guess I call you that. Is that a proper appellation?
Yes.
Mr. X? I'm wondering if you still believe, as I think you certainly did at the time you were allied to the black Muslim movement, in a segregated black nation
No.
in North America.
I don't believe in any form of segregation or any form of racism. I'm against any form of segregation and against racism.
Am I right in saying that the black Muslim movement, which you have left, did believe in that?
Well, Elijah Muhammad taught his followers that the only solution was a separate state
Yeah.
for black people. And as long as I thought he genuinely believed that himself, I believed in him and believed in his solution. But when I began to doubt that he himself believed that that was feasible, and I saw no kind of action designed to bring it into existence or bring it about, then I turned in a different direction.
Are you still a Muslim yourself?
Oh, yes. I'm a Muslim. I believe in the religion of Islam, which believes in brotherhood, complete brotherhood of all people. But at the same time that I believe in this brotherhood, I don't believe in forcing my desire for brotherhood upon those who aren't willing to accept it.
Of course, I think the Christians would say that they also believe in brotherhood. What did you say to that?
I'd say they believe in it, but don't practice it.
Well, that'd be a pretty good answer.
Sir, when the Muezzin
goes up in the minaret. Twice a day, he cries to the world, there is but one God, and he is Allah. Do you deny that there is a Christian God?
The muezzin does this five times a day.
Five times, and I only heard him twice.
Well, you were fortunate to hear him twice. But he does this five times a day, and the same God that he says that he expresses the existence of is the God that the Christians profess to believe in themselves, and the God that the Jews believe in, one God, the creator of the universe. The Muslims believe in the God that created the universe, and I think the Christians do, and the Jews do. Now, as long as all of them are talking about the Creator, the Jews may call him Jehovah, and Christians may have another name for him. Those who are Arabic-speaking refer to him as Allah. Well, we believe in the same God.
Now, as the Muslim religion advances in the United States, are you modernizing it or sticking with the old faiths? For example, the complete segregation of the sexes.
I think that everything today on this earth is being modernized. Religious principles and practices, as well as political and other things.
Now, when you went to Mecca, this is a very sacred and forbidden city. I tried to get to Mecca myself and certainly didn't make it, not being a Muslim. But how would they accept you as one? You're an American. There are few American Muslims.
This is true. And by being an American and not having any... not being able to speak the Arabic language, I did strike a snag, a very serious snag, but I was fortunate to have been pretty well known by the officials in Arabia, and they knew too that I had accepted Orthodox Islam. It had been highly publicized in the paper, and I became a guest of the state. I was a guest of Prince Faisal, the present King Faisal, and they made it possible for me to go before the committee, Hajj committee or Hajj court, who examines you and asks you questions about your belief, and if you pass it, then you are okay to go to Mecca.
But it's you would true. Have to have a translator then.
Oh, I had one. Then realizing that our problem in America, that we are black Americans, and we have a problem that goes beyond religion, we formed a group known as the Organization of Afro-American Unity. And the objective of this organization, it's non-religious, number one, any Negro can belong to it, and the objective of that organization is to bring about a condition that will guarantee respect and recognition of the 22 million black Americans as human beings. We feel that the problem, number one, of the black man in America is beyond America's ability to solve. It's a human problem, not an American problem or a Negro problem. And as a human problem or a world problem, we feel that it should be taken out of the jurisdiction of the United States government and the United States courts and taken into the United Nations in the same manner that the problems of the black man in South Africa, Angola, and other parts of the world, and even the way they're trying to bring the problems of the Jews in Russia into the United Nations because of violation of human rights. We believe that our problem is one not of violation of civil rights, but a violation of human rights. Not only are we denied the right to be a citizen in the United States, we're denied the right to be a human being.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Black History is American History.